So I'm delighted to introduce Laura Anderson as our colloquium speaker today. So Laura is a string theorist, and she's interested in the connections between string theory, geometry, and particle physics. So Laura got her PhD from Oxford in 2008, and then she was a postdoctoral fellow at UPenn and also at Harvard before starting as faculty at Virginia Tech in 2013. Laura is also one of our Emmy Noether Fellows this year, and so we hope that she'll be able to visit us sometime in person, hopefully soon. So for today, so Laura will tell us all about the geometry of string compactifications. And so whenever you're ready, Laura, take it away.
Thanks very much. Yep. So as Neil said, I think the original plan was that I was actually going to be at the Institute this semester. So I'm sorry that that didn't happen this year, but I'm pleased that I get a chance to visit even virtually briefly. So thanks everyone for turning up. And I hope this will be fun as a conversation. So as Neil mentioned, my subject is a fairly technical one. I work in string geometry, the interface of algebraic geometry and string theory. This is a subject that is difficult to give a colloquium for a broad audience on, so I've given my best effort at sort of motivating a set of ideas and giving a flavor for some of the results that my group has been working on in recent years. But feel free to interrupt me, ask questions if things are either unclear or you'd like more details or anything as we go along. So let me start with a bit of broad motivation. A question that you might be interested in, the Institute is interested in general, is searching for new physics in a variety of contexts. So very roughly, I think we might all agree that there are sort of two broad ways to try and hunt for new physics. You can use a bottom-up approach in which you perturb away from phenomena that you've observed already, or you can try and use some sort of top-down approach to hunt for new physics. Something that I think is also very much in the spirit of interests of perimeter is to ask what constrained frameworks can you use to try and produce a top-down model of new physics? And gravity, of course, is one that has the potential to give you interesting new information. So I'm going to be talking about the right-hand side approach, fairly obviously. And let me do the one slide overview of string theory. What is everything about? Why are we doing what we're doing? So again, a point that I think everybody might agree on is that consistent quantum theories of gravity are rare. This is not to claim that string theory is the only such theory or even necessarily the one that has anything to do with our universe, but string theory has been shown to have a lot of potential in terms of being a powerful extension of quantum field theory, describing effective field theories in diverse dimensions, and potentially giving rise to some interesting new physical phenomena, new models that could have an impact on a variety of physical systems. So there certainly has been lots of productive links to mathematics. Several Fields medals have come from a dialogue between string theory and math. And the connections to physics are somewhat harder to come by in terms of, you know, concrete observations. But I'll talk a little bit more today about how one could attempt to bridge that gap and what it is that you might try and ask. So string theory, as I am assuming that most people in this audience are familiar with, is a model of which you're trying to model fundamental interactions of nature through vibrating modes of very tiny one-dimensional objects. And this has a remarkable consequence that Einstein's theory of general relativity arises as a low energy limit of the theory for free, i.e. you try and model particle interactions and you get gravity for free to some extent. However, it comes with a really big catch, which is the theory is inherently formulated in more than three spatial dimensions. So this, of course, says that unless you want to be describing models of physics in 10 dimensions, you need to describe how this could possibly be consistent with observation. And the standard picture, which again, most people who've heard anything about string theory have probably seen at some point before, is that we don't actually know that our universe is 3+1 dimensional. We know that the macroscopic dimensions are three spatial and one time-like dimension, but it's possible that there could be extra directions that are very small or compact compared to the dimensions that we observe around us. So the search for extra dimensions of various sizes is one that's ongoing in many good groups and labs around the world. But certainly consistent with experiments, small extra dimensions are in the game. So whether one likes this as a philosophical or a matter of taste in terms of physics, you can ask, can I use string theory as a quantum theory of gravity? Can I roll with the fact that it predicts more spatial dimensions than I might have observed believed to be there? Can I try and push that further and say, if I want string theory to actually be a model of, say, the physics of our four-dimensional world, how could I accomplish that? So the picture would be just like we look in these, you know, various diagrams from far away. You see a rope stretching over this gap in the ground in one of my diagrams here. If you zoom in up close, of course, that rope looks like one-dimensional object from far away. Up close, it has an extra dimension, the radial direction of that rope. And that would be a compact direction compared to the length of the string. So 2D surface of the rope looks like 1D from far away. Likewise, we could zoom in very close on spacetime and find extra small directions that things could move in at a very small scale. The shapes of those extra dimensions could be simple or complicated. So string compactification is the process of doing this dimensional reduction, reducing a higher dimensional theory down to a lower one in whatever number of dimensions you're interested in working in. I'm going to be interested for this talk in modeling four-dimensional physics. So very roughly, what does that look like? The questions that I want to ask are within the context of string theory. Of course, the laws of physics are going to change with the existence of those extra dimensions. So if string theory seriously predicts that it is a higher dimensional theory, then we need to ask what kind of shapes of these extra dimensions are allowed. How do these different geometries change the physical theories that we could produce in lower dimensions, including particle symmetries interactions? And is there any choice of a string compactification that could produce physics that agrees with what we already know? For example, the standard model of particle physics, models of cosmology, inflation, and so on. What new physics might they also predict? So ideally, if you wanted string theory to be a theory of the real world, you would say, let me reproduce the physics I already know is there and make concrete predictions for what could be still to be discovered. So this process of trying to map out which effective four-dimensional theories could arise from string theory is broadly a topic of a lot of investigation in the field right now under the so-called Swampland program. And the basic questions are to try and understand the shape of this Venn diagram that I put at the bottom of the slide. You want to ask, what theories am I interested in? Broadly, I'm calling that string phenomenology, i.e. any physical theory that I want to try and match to, whether it be the standard model, particle physics, cosmology, et cetera. The space of all possible theories that I could get from string theory, that's my lighter purple circle here, and then of course all 4D effective theories beyond that. Phrased differently, you could ask the question, within the space of 4D effective theories, how many of them could be completed to a quantum theory of gravity of any form, and can you, you know, work out rules for compatibility of those types of theories? So again, this is a thing that lots of people are thinking about. All right, so very roughly putting now some equations to all those words, what does the sort of process of string compactification look like? So at its most basic level, we can begin with even classical bosonic theories in higher dimensions, say a 10-dimensional Lagrangian, like I've written here. This is a piece of the Lagrangian for the 10-dimensional heterotic string, which is one of several different flavors of 10-dimensional string theories. And the idea is, beginning with this 10D theory, we're going to look for solutions of the form that produce Minkowski space times some compact six manifold. And very roughly, what we would like to do is integrate out the dependence on those six compact directions. Since they're compact, that should be a finite contribution to an integral. And that produces for you some 4D effective theory left over. Now, you can ask, what are the equations of motion that I produce from such a theory? And of course, they're going to constrain the gauge fields and the metric that appear in the 10-dimensional theory, and hence what solutions I can find. So one class of solutions, the very first one that was written down by Candelas, Strominger, Horowitz, and Witten in the very first string compactification nearly 30 years ago that someone wrote down, would be to consider manifolds of SU3 holonomy. These are also known as Ricci flat Kähler manifolds or a Calabi-Yau manifold. These are complex manifolds, so frequently in this talk I'll refer to them as a Calabi-Yau threefold, six real dimensions, three complex dimensions. And also the gauge fields that descend from 10 dimensions will have to obey certain equations. I'm going to come back to those in a moment. So picture, we have some very complicated shape of extra dimensions up here. Here's the Calabi-Yau manifold, the choice of a solution to the theory that would produce Minkowski background. And we have flat space that we would like to live in, non-compact, large dimensions. So before I can say a little bit more about the effective physics that I would expect from such a process, I need to encode just a little bit more in the geometry that I'm describing. So of course, as this particular audience, I don't need to motivate at all to physical theories and the spaces that they live in are very correlated objects. So specifically, the symmetries of spaces very much impact physical laws, as we've seen from everything to, you know, conservation theorems through to general relativity. So geometrically, of course, we need to be able to encode what symmetries are living in the 10-dimensional theory, and then how those symmetries, specifically gauge symmetries is what I have in mind here, are going to descend to the lower dimensional space. Mathematically, that goes under the subject of describing those gauge interactions via fiber bundles or vector bundles. Mathematically, this is just a surjective morphism such that the inverse image of points in some base manifold, let me call that X, are homotopic, i.e. they look the same. So very roughly, for those of you that haven't encountered this notation before, which maybe no one, but let me just say it for completeness, a bundle is very loosely something that looks like a direct product of two manifolds, a base and a fiber, but can be non-trivially twisted over the base. So this global topology does not have to be trivial, and it's a way of encoding information at each point in a space. Specifically, the information, of course, that I want to encode in this context is going to be gauge freedom. Example, U1 gauge freedom. You have to keep track of one complex number at each point in a space. That produces for you an abelian vector bundle. Another example would be the tangent bundle to a manifold. The vector space that you're keeping track of at each point is the tangent space to that manifold, and so that forms the fiber over the base, being the manifold itself. Why am I bothering to formulate gauge theory in this language? Because, of course, what I'm interested in is what can be the shapes of these extra dimensions in string theory, and then how does that play with the gauge interactions that I can actually achieve in four dimensions? So of course, not every vector bundle can exist over every space. The form of a manifold that you're trying to write down gauge interactions over is constrained and bounded. There are whole classification problems of what bundles can exist over what spaces. As a very silly example, if you wanted to do U1 gauge physics over the circle, there are two topologically distinct ways you can do that, either through the trivial direct product of an interval or an infinite line, depending on how you want to set it up, over a circle, or the non-trivial fibration, which is a Mobius strip. So where this arises in the context of string theory and string compactifications is that if we begin with gauge theories in higher dimensions, say 10, then when we reduce, we're asking the question of what can be the physical configuration of gauge field VEVs over those compact directions. And mathematically, we have a classification problem of what vector bundles can exist on this class of spaces. So if, for example, I'm interested in the gauge interactions of the standard model, SU3 times SU2 times U1, I can ask which gauge bundles can I realize over a space such as one illustrated here. This is the three spatial dimensional shadow of a six dimensional Calabi-Yau manifold that's been depicted here. So there is a geometric classification problem to characterize gauge physics in lower dimensions. The example that I'm going to illustrate for today's talk is, again, the one that was used very initially, the very first examples of string compactification, and that is the E8 cross E8 heterotic string. There we begin in 10 dimensions with the Lie group, 16-dimensional Lie group E8 times E8. In a single E8 factor, we have a 248-dimensional adjoint representation and quite a lot of structure. In fact, this is the only matter that appears in the 10-dimensional E8 cross E8 string. So the only matter you have is a gauge field, and you can ask what happens to it as you reduce down to four dimensions. Of course, this bundle and its symmetry can be broken over into parts that live over the compact space and parts that are left over in four dimensions. And the hard part is going to be to choose the bundle and the compact directions to leave behind a piece of E8 that would give the symmetry and particles of, say, the standard model that we see in nature. This is just one of many questions you could ask, but if you're interested in engineering 4D physics that might be a model of our world, that might be a requirement that you would be interested in. So let me return now just briefly to the toy example of dimensional reduction that I showed you before. I have a Lagrangian in 10D. I'm looking for a solution that is Minkowski space times x6. I mentioned that one solution to the equations of motion is a so-called Calabi-Yau manifold, SU3 holonomy. But we also have non-trivial equations that we have to solve for the gauge bundle. And I just want to point that out. These are the so-called Hermitian-Yang-Mills equations. Here we have a solution for gauge fields that involves the condition that the vector bundle be so-called holomorphic. It's 2-0 and 0-2 pieces of the field strength vanish. And the 1-1 part contracted with the Ricci-flat Calabi-Yau metric must be 0. I'll talk more about this later, but just to begin to illustrate some of the difficulties of string compactifications, although there is a Fields model for proving that Ricci flat metrics exist on Calabi-Yau manifolds, no metrics are known explicitly, except in trivial cases. And so actually solving this nonlinear PDE for a connection is a very non-trivial thing. If you don't even know the Calabi-Yau metric, it's very difficult to solve for what the gauge field does. So we're going to try and parameterize a solution in which the metric and gauge fields from higher dimensions are the key ingredients, and we don't necessarily explicitly know what they are yet. So that can be tricky. However, even parameterizing our ignorance, we do know that the origin of matter that we'll see in a four-dimensional theory is going to be fully constrained by the form of the 10D gauge field. In the example I'm showing you here, I'm beginning with a 248-dimensional representation, adjoint representation of E8 in 10D. And then there's a very simple question you can ask, which is if you have a gauge field with a single, you know, gauge index on it in 10D, space-time index, then you can say, what does this look like when the gauge index either lives over the 4D portion or the 6D portion of that index range, that 10D index range? Obviously, if your gauge index is living over the 4D portion, you're going to get a gauge field in four dimensions. And if it's living over the 6D directions, from the point of view of the four-dimensional theory, you're going to get a scalar field. Specifically, you can make that a bit more precise by considering fluctuations around a background choice of gauge field. Again, considering fluctuations around a choice of background gauge field BEV is one way to physically say it. And these will look like 4D scalar fields. So here, the thing in the box, the delta C, this is what is observable as a scalar field from the 4D theory. And this can be expanded in a set of harmonic bundle-valued one forms that live over the compact six-dimensional space. So very loosely, if you put gauge field VEVs in a group G over the Calabi-Yau directions, then the remaining gauge symmetry that you're going to end up with in four dimensions will be the commutant of G. And here I've labeled it H with inside E8. So in order to find the massless modes, you can show that the condition on these forms is that they are harmonic. You're solving just a vanishing of a Dirac operator acting on a state. And so phrased in terms of fluctuations, these don't change the equations of motion. These are flat directions of the potential. And so the gauge field BEVs that you choose over the Calabi-Yau, these are going to break the 4D symmetry. Here, I think I labeled it the other way around. If you value them in H, they'll break to G or vice versa. Okay, why am I telling you this? Because I'm in the business of starting with this 10D theory, trying to say what 4D physics I can read off. So this slide, the goal is to say that simply from the structure of just gauge fields in 10 dimensions, I suddenly have a bunch of massless scalars that can appear in the four-dimensional theory that will be valued in representations of groups that are maximal subgroups of E8 in this case. And I can figure out exactly how many of them and what type by considering how the adjoint representation of E8 decomposes. So as an example that people have looked at in the past, imagine that I consider the SU5 times SU5 maximal subgroup of E8. Then the branching of the 248-dimensional representation tells me that I can have the following product representations of SU5 times SU5. And this is it. So within a hadronic theory, I don't get to have any other matter in four dimensions. The only matter was the 10D gauge field. And this will descend to 4D scalars valued in the representations you see here. So for example, you can have 5 bars, 10 bars. That's it in SU5. Notice that from the point of view of building, for example, an SU5 grand unified theory in four dimensions, this is very constrained. So there's no adjoint valued Higgs as a scalar field, for example. This tells you just from group theory what type of matter can exist in 4D, but it doesn't tell you how much of it is, i.e. the multiplicity of them, the massless states. For that, you have to ask, this expansion that I did to describe the gauge field, I expanded in the basis of harmonic forms over a manifold in order to parameterize the scalars. The space of all such closed but not exact one forms is called a bundle-valued cohomology group. It's denoted here. H1 tells me about the one-form index that's living over the Calabi-Yau directions. X tells me which manifold. And this structure here is telling me which representation of a vector bundle this form is valued in. So this is just telling me the index structure of some form that lives over the Calabi-Yau. The multiplicity of how many of those are closed but not exact, that is going to tell me how many states I have in the theory. So the particles and symmetries of the 4D theory are entirely fixed by this choice of compact geometry, the Calabi-Yau, and a vector bundle over it. Now you could ask the following question. Can I actually achieve the particles and spectrum of the standard model? Can I, for example, find three families of quarks and leptons, which would be, you know, SU3 times SU2 times U1, and the appropriate charged matter? So that's a fair question. And you might argue that physics, of course, is all in the business of making predictions. So the ideas as I laid them out, can you write down, you know, a 10-dimensional string theory? Can you do this dimensional reduction and work out whether you can have physics that at least agrees with the interactions in nature that we know of so far? This has been attractive for over 20 years in string theory. In principle, every tunable parameter in the low energy physics, for example, all 25 free parameters in the standard model, interactions of particles, strengths of couplings, mass of the electron, take your pick. All of these are fixed by the choice of background. And so if you got this right, it could be extremely predictive in terms of what physics could be compatible with that in the string background. So this seems like a straightforward thing to ask. It has been asked for 20 years. So what exactly has taken so long? The hard part is, again, our ignorance of being able to actually solve the horrible higher dimensional nonlinear PDEs that we need to answer that question. So if we could just do the integration, if we could solve the equations, if we knew our metric and we knew the gauge field and you could integrate out this Lagrangian, you know, in the compact directions as I described before, you could just answer this question definitively and we could all move on, more or less. The hard part is that there are a bunch of serious mathematical obstacles to actually solving that. So people have done lots of things, you know, clever ways of trying to work around that problem. And I'm going to try and summarize some of the obstacles that people have faced and then where the prospects are for how one could actually definitively answer this question. And personally, I am quite agnostic as to whether I think string theory can model the physics that we see in nature or not. But I think it's an interesting question to try and be able to answer. And I think the hope of actually being able to push some of these answers further than before is quite strong, thanks to a lot of new mathematical progress. So that's my goal to outline to you in the remainder of my talk. We would rather not be like the XKCD string summary here. Okay, so just a reminder, again, in terms of the goal, we know a lot about nature already. Here is a very non-exhaustive list of random things that one can use to constrain the physical theories that you know about. So if you're writing down this highly constrained string compactification, if even one of these is wrong, you can rule out the model. So we could move on. We could say string theory definitively, you know, this branch of string theory, at least, you know, I'm describing heterotic, for example, you could rule out and say cannot produce for you 4D physics like we see in nature. Here are the challenges, though, that we have to overcome. There are many consistent, though not realistic, geometries known. So these choices of Calabi-Yau manifolds and vector bundles that I highlighted for you earlier, it is not even known if the list of all such things is finite. We have very clever people who spent a lot of time trying to generate example geometries of the type I'm describing, and there's roughly 500 million examples known. The dots in this diagram, this is a famous plot of topological data of Calabi-Yau threefolds built as toric hypersurfaces that was first produced by Kreutzer and Skarka about 20 years ago. And each of these dots represents a topological type. There's more than one manifold with that topological type, roughly 500 million manifolds and counting. So that's a lot. That's a lot to consider. Each of these could be a background for the theory. Each of these could produce a four-dimensional theory of the type I'm describing. Even worse, even if I just pick one of these out of a hat, as I've already described, I don't know the metric and I don't know the gauge field. So a lot of parts of the calculation that I would like to do, for example, explicit calculation of particle masses in a vacuum, like the mass of the electron, depends on these quantities that I don't know and in a key way. So actually getting at that information can be difficult. And there are other generic features of the effective theory that I can calculate that are problematic. And this has to do with the idea of so-called moduli or massless scalars that appear that do not match what we see in nature. So let me say a little bit more about those. The six-dimensional Calabi-Yau manifold has parameters associated to the metric. These are degrees of freedom, you know, fluctuations of the metric that are preserving the Ricci flatness condition that is required for the equations of motion. And roughly, these correspond to the size and, quote, shape of the manifold. Phrased a bit more precisely, these are the Kähler and complex structure moduli of this Kähler and complex manifold. For a given manifold, there's order 100 such parameters for each of those 500 million in the list that I mentioned, and string theory does not specify their values. They're complete flat directions of the potential from the point of view of the 4D theory. That is highly unphysical. We don't see a couple hundred massless scalars floating around in nature. So unless we add something to the theory to fix the size and shape of these directions, this would lead to unphysical massless particles in 4D. Just to say again, these are things, the number of these is topology here, so the classic illustration of changing the coffee cup into the donut. These are deformations that are allowed that preserve topology, same for size and shape. Okay. This is referred to, and again, since I'm sure you've heard more than one talk on string theory in recent years, this is part of what's been referred to as the string landscape problem. Once you add flux potentials to the theory, there's some extra ingredients you can add to lift moduli. There's the possibility of getting a lot of vacuum out of the theory, even for one choice of geometry. So a famous calculation done in the context of type 2 string theory said maybe 10 to the 500 vacuum. And this is something that has been leveled against string theory very strongly, as there's no hope that this theory will even be predictive, because say you are able to calculate the things you want to calculate, if there's 10 to the 500 vacua, what is this actually going to be useful for in terms of predicting anything? This seems like a lost cause to begin with. However, I would argue that that argument, both the 10 to the 500 as a number and also that argument, isn't actually the most relevant question. So the 10 to the 500 is, first off, not a counting of theories that matters at all for the question of realistic physics in four dimensions. So the theory, the 10 to the 500 counting of vacua was done for type 2 theories, n equals 2, in which you did not have an electron in any of those theories. So I can write down an infinite number of quantum field theories that have nothing to do with nature, and that's fine. Nobody cares about that. What I care about is the fact that I can write down a quantum field theory that does have something to do with nature. So in terms of a string compactification, rather than say there are potentially quite a lot of vacua of string theory, the question you want to ask are there any classes of vacua that do have something potentially to do with 4D physics as we see it? So the catch is that unlike in field theory, where we're able to write down the standard model as a field theory and then run with it, we're not allowed to do that within string theory. We have to replace the question of which field theory with which geometry. So now that I would say that the real question, which could still kill this whole program very rapidly, is you need to characterize what are the physically relevant geometries for the classes of field theories that you actually care about. How many vacua of those do you have? And I will argue for you that in the limited studies that have been done on this, rather than having 10 to the 500, it's going to be far more likely that you're going to have none. It's actually extremely hard to produce theories that look like what we see in nature. Okay. So I have illustrated a variety of questions here. In order to make progress on string phenomenology, you have to make progress on some of the points that I've mentioned. And this really leads to physicists such as myself needing to bridge the gap to differential and algebraic geometry to be able to push some of these geometric questions further and extract the physics that you're interested in. So here's what you need, I would argue, in order to have a serious and systematic approach to some of these questions. You need a study of string vacua that is algorithmic, computational, and large scale. We know there's at least 500 million solutions of this one type that I've been describing for you. There's other types possible. So you have huge numbers of possible geometries and vacua. You can't do that a case at a time. You have to be able to do this computationally and exhaustively. You also need new mathematical tools to fully extract and characterize the low energy theories. This is involving both solutions to complicated PDEs and also novel tools within differential and algebraic geometry to extract some of the features for things that you can't solve. And finally, you need novel mechanisms to address obstacles such as the moduli stabilization problem and others. So these are the broad goals that motivate my personal program of research, and I'm going to try and use my remaining few minutes to illustrate some recent progress, and again, why there may be some hope that this isn't totally a lost cause, or that we may be able to definitively rule things out in the not-so-distant future. So let me touch briefly on the process of trying to make contact with theories that look a little bit like the standard model of particle physics. So a question, a program that started roughly 7 years ago with my collaborators and I, we attempted to generate a very large-scale data set of geometries in string theory that had the exact charge matter spectrum of the standard model. These are far from realistic models in lots of ways, as I will show you. We have not, for example, solved problems like the cosmological constant problem or, you know, having a fully stable vacuum of the theory, lots of things that you would need to have a complete theory. But if we can't produce, even in the ballpark of the standard model spectrum, then we are not interested in that theory to begin with. So this is an initial pass at trying to narrow what types of geometries are you interested in. We chose, as again, to produce a data set of enough objects to be able to study this significantly. We chose a simple abelian probe construction of vector bundles over Calabi-Yau's, which allowed us to produce very large numbers of consistent geometries. Specifically, we generated a data set of about 10 to the 40 string geometries. If you've ever tried to store anything in a computer, you know that 10 to the 40 is a ridiculous number, so we're not actually storing 10 to the 40 geometries in any concrete sense, but we have a range of parameters that we were able to scan over and that could produce these geometries, which was very large indeed, and we can extract from that those that exactly match the particle spectrum and symmetries of the standard model. This effort was begun 7 years ago and is still ongoing, and we produced the largest and most systematic data set of its kind in string theory. We scanned for coarse properties of 4D physics that were consistent with experiment, and what we see is that even quasi-realistic string geometry is very rare. So we're trying to extract further patterns from that. But let me give you some examples. So of this initial data set of about 10 to the 40 geometries, those that could actually generate exactly the massless spectrum of the standard model and nothing else, this would be, you know, before Higgs breaking. There was only 400 of those. Those that had a single Higgs doublet pair were only, you know, 262. If you're willing to have multiple Higgs doublet pairs, they were slightly higher. We asked that the rank of the Yukawa matrix, i.e. the quark masses, be greater than zero, no proton decay, and a few other very coarse features. And very rapidly, you drop from 10 to the 40 down to like 13. So this is an astonishing set of constraints that really limit what types of geometry you're interested in. Now, of course, the question is, what are those that you're interested like? Can you characterize them? Try and rule them out a bit more systematically. So, of course, having standard model-like theories isn't good enough. You must be able to determine what they have in common or where they fail. You want to spot some general structure. So one example of that general structure that we were able to observe was in symmetry breaking down to SU3 times SU2 times U1 of the standard model. So there are different ways to break symmetry. In standard 4D gut constructions, for example, SU5 guts, as I mentioned, adjoint Higgsing of the SU5 down to SU3 times SU2 times U1. So an ordinary Higgs mechanism is the standard way of breaking symmetry. Within string theory, because of this constrained matter spectrum that I can achieve from the heterotic string, that is not available to us. And so instead, the only mechanism that really works for breaking symmetry is the so-called Hosotani mechanism or Wilson lines. For people unfamiliar with these are basically configurations of background gauge fields that produce an effect very similar to the Aronoff-Bohm effect, namely that you have a non-trivial potential but not field strength for the gauge fields. We were able to prove through a variety of means that, in fact, only Wilson line breaking is compatible with standard model spectrum within a heterotic theory, independent of manifold bundler construction. So we started with an initial data set, we observed a pattern, and then we're able to extract that to a general feature of a heterotic compactification. This leads to important 4D signatures. The type of grand unified theories that you produce in four dimensions are very distinct in this context from what you would achieve from normal four-dimensional grand unified theories. For example, there's no doublet-triplet splitting problem, no relations, problematic relations between couplings, possible residual discrete symmetries, and so on. So there is potential signatures that could either be useful or could kill the resulting theories that you write down. More structure like this is what we're in the process of hunting for within a program of this type. Let me comment on a slightly different take. So you might again say, all right, fine, you picked 10 to the 40 solutions out of a hat. Good for you. That was a large computational task. But if you don't even know that the set of such things are finite, then what are we doing, right? So another program that people have been thinking a lot about, including myself, is ways where you could try and actually prove finiteness for the number of background geometries that arise in string compactifications. At least for one data set of Calabi-Yaus, you know that there is a finite number. And this is the set of Calabi-Yau manifolds that can be written as a so-called vibration. This is very similar mathematically to the definition of a bundle. Again, surjective morphism. Here, the claim is that almost all fibers of this object are homotopic. These from the Calabi-Yau case were classified by Mark Gross. And he has a lovely proof, non-constructive, that all Calabi-Yaus that admit a vibration, specifically he was interested in a case where the target of the surjective morphism was a complex surface and the fiber was a one-dimensional manifold, one complex dimensional manifold. These are known to be finite. These fibered manifolds are a subset of all Calabi-Yaus. They're known to be finite. And again, what types of vibrations you can have is a very constrained problem. These are also interesting in playing a role in string dualities. Basically, having a vibration structure within your manifold allows you to say that different types of string theories will lead to the same effective physics. So just as a silly example of this, one that arises in the context of n equals one supersymmetric string compactifications, which is broadly where the heterotic theories that I described live, is compactifications of so-called F-theory. F-theory is a geometrization of the type 2B axiodilaton via describing a fibered space in which the elliptic fiber plays the role of the symmetries of the axiodilaton. Why am I telling you this and why do you care? You only care because this is some other construction of string theory, different dimensionality here, Calabi-Yau fourfold for the internal dimensions, eight compact directions rather than six from before. And this construction could also give rise to potentially realistic 4D physics as well. And if you have fibered manifolds on both sides, it turns out you can prove that these are will lead to exactly the same physics. So rather than explore two different constructions of string theory, you can use duality to say that these would must give you the same space and solutions. Specifically, a heterotic theory on an elliptically fibered Calabi-Yau threefold is dual to F theory on a Calabi-Yau fourfold, which is K3 fibered over the same base. Okay, string dualities are useful. Again, you might ask, why do we care? The main reason that we care is that this could provide a very strong window into finiteness. So by breaking the manifold into its fiber and base, it's much easier to describe and classify. This decomposition will actually make many features of the effective theory much more calculable, including particle spectrums, couplings, and forms of the metric. And so we can ask what vibrations can arise. Various groups, myself and two of my collaborators, James Gray here at BT as well, and Wadi Taylor at MIT, have been working on this. And we made the surprising observation independently and together in various contexts that, in fact, the vast majority of known Calabi-Yaus that anyone has constructed, including this half billion that I mentioned before, actually all are of this finite fibered type. Specifically, if you take all these different dots that represent different topological Calabi-Yaus, this is a plot back from 2012. There's this is much denser now, but hard to plot because of the density of these. Basically, everything in this plot is actually also a fibered manifold. It can be broken into this fiber-based geometry in a straightforward way. So studying and classifying these vibrations has allowed to pull these complicated manifolds apart. One thing that is very useful about this is that the topology of Calabi-Yau manifolds tells you that if they exist as a fibration, then their fibers must be other Calabi-Yau manifolds. So in the process of classifying Calabi-Yaus, if you start as complex manifolds first, you start as a complex one-fold, there is in fact a unique complex one-fold, the elliptic curve, or as a real manifold, a two-torus, that is Ricci flat, Kähler, and a solution to the string equations of motion. There's also a unique complex twofold or real fourfold, the so-called K3 surface. So if you are in the process of trying to characterize Calabi-Yau threefolds now, six real dimensional manifolds, and you say they are fibered, then the vibrations must be either T2 or K3. These are unique. And so it's only a question of how these fibers then can be twisted over the base, which you have a chance to characterize a lot more explicitly. So on the mathematics side, work by Mark Gross, Antonella Grassi, and more recent work by DiCerbo and Spaldi for higher dimensional Calabi-Yaus has made great progress in characterizing what base manifolds can be realized in Calabi-Yau geometries, both threefolds and fourfolds. My collaborators and I have developed algorithmic tools to find all fibrations for known data sets of Calabi-Yaus. This is how we noticed that all of them were fibered. And even more remarkably, we find that if you pick a general manifold out of a hat, a generic Calabi-Yau doesn't just admit one fibration, it actually admits many vibrations. So mathematically, this is kind of a surprising result. There are not many, to my knowledge, complex manifolds that have this type of multiplicity of vibration structure sort of naturally occurring in them. So what do I mean by different vibrations? I mean different ways up. So remember in my vibration picture, the vibration was sort of stacking one bit of geometry over another, like the interval over the circle to produce the cylinder or the Mobius strip. So it is a way of taking apart the manifold as this part lives over this part in multiple different ways. Each of those is surjective morphism of the type I described here. And here the superscripts over these arrows are saying that each of these is in this case an elliptic fibration, hence this script E, or a T2 fibered over some base complex surface. We can actually count for each of these how many fibrations in an enumerative geometry kind of way you would expect for each manifold. And for data sets, we have done this exhaustively, and we find for Calabi-Yau threefolds that the number of fibrations per configuration in an initial data set ran from, you know, sort of 5 up to 35, and the number of manifolds that had that property was shown here. For fourfolds, as they could arise in F-theory, this was even higher. In fact, we showed for Calabi-Yau threefolds that are known within the toric data set so far, there's actually one manifold that admits an infinite number of inequivalent descriptions as a fibration. Okay, mathematically interesting fact, but again, why am I bothering to tell you this? The hope and what we've observed based on all the data sets of Calabi-Yaus that we have so far is that it seems, experimentally at least at this point, that we may be able to establish that every Calabi-Yau manifold with large enough topology, specifically for those interested, the Hodge number is H11 bigger than 18, will admit an elliptic fibration. If that is true, and we know that the set of elliptic fibrations is finite, now you have a real shot at trying to establish finiteness of the set of all Calabi-Yaus. In addition, because fibrations play such a crucial role in string dualities, this allows you to try and map out not just one corner of string compactification, for example, the heterotic strings that I mentioned previously, but instead you could try and build actually a duality cartography to say that these different corners of string theory may actually produce, if sort of everything has the structure necessary to produce the same classes of effective theories, you may be having a very redundant description of the space of possible string vacua by having different types of string theory. So this may be much easier or simpler a set of vacua than you had realized before because many things are related. All right, how does one actually, just to give you a flavor of how does one go about trying to bound these fibrations, the steps towards proving finiteness, we have shown that for known data sets of Calabi-Yaus, any manifold is either fibered or it can actually be connected to an elliptically fibered manifold via a finite number of so-called geometric transitions. These are also known as flops or confolds. So even for the non-geometrically inclined, this is pretty easy to say what the idea is for the geometry. The idea is that you can start with a geometry that is, say, smooth, deform it to a singular point. So you can give it a spike in the diagram shown here. And then you can perform a resolution, a small resolution, which is very akin to the mathematical notion of blow-up, in which you introduce a new direction in the geometry to smooth out the singularity. So in this picture, if I have a curve that has a double point, as is shown down below here, if I can pull that curve out of the plane that it lives in onto this other direction, I can smooth it out into a smooth parametric curve. Likewise, you can do the same thing for higher dimensional varieties. If you can extend them in new directions, you can pull this double point away. Another thing you could do would be to keep it in the plane and simply deform the curve so that it no longer crosses itself in that way. And that's sort of this side of the picture. So through simple mathematical relations that arise in birational geometry, we're able to control whether something is fibered or not by simply making it singular and repairing that singularity in a controllable manner. This is a constrained thing within the class of Calabi-Yau geometry and is part of the so-called minimal model program within differential geometry and is a powerful tool for characterizing complex geometries in general. So that's just a flavor of concretely how we're going at it. I don't have time to talk about this in detail today, but you might ask, this sounds like a lot of, you know, as I've described it, differential and algebraic geometry. So why are physicists working on this? It turns out that this process of forming these singular transitions or in fact bounding these elliptic vibrations actually has a strong interplay with physics. So the numbers that appear that constrain the geometry have to do with cancellations of anomalies in various dimensions. They have to do with, you know, physical transitions that are allowed in terms of the branch space of effective theories. So it turns out that you can actually learn fruitful information both from the effective physics side and the constrained geometry side. Another brief application for fibered manifolds, and again, why this big, potentially infinite set of manifolds can start compacting down to something much smaller is that within the context of, for example, heterotic compactifications, you can show that if everything admits vibrations, as the way I was describing, then this actually gives very strong signatures in terms of the effective physics that you might see. And this is through something called so-called topological vanishings of couplings. The basic idea within writing down an effective theory, usually if you're writing down a Lagrangian for a theory, you write down all the terms in a potential that are allowed by gauge invariants. You have to have a reason for a gauge allowed coupling to not be there. Frequently for physical applications, we're interested in particle textures or hierarchies that are not just the ones that are imposed on us by gauge symmetry. So for example, in the standard model, the fact that you have a very heavy top quark is something that you need an explanation for. The so-called mu problem in supersymmetric theories of having a bare Higgs mass that is too large, something that people work hard to try and figure out how to forbid. There may be operators that facilitate rapid proton decay that you need to kill, and so on. So a topological vanishing is any couplings that must be zero for a class of theories that are not simply those that would be zero by gauge invariants. Gauge allowed operators that must nonetheless be zero for other reasons. So you can show that in the context of heterotic theories on elliptically fibered Clavier manifolds, in fact, topological vanishings are generic and could be either useful or dangerous depending on the outcome of the theory, but again, quite restrictive in terms of what you could extract. As a final comment, so far I've talked a lot about string theory as it existed, perhaps, 20 years ago, before the deep brain revolution. So for those of you that have heard of that, you might say, you're talking, about closed string degrees of freedom a lot. What about more modern, brain physics as it appears in string theory? Of course, strings are not the only dynamical objects. You can also have dynamical boundary conditions for open strings, i.e. brains. It turns out that Calabi-Yau geometry, and specifically this vibration structure that I've been describing, actually helps you to extract a lot of very deep information about open string physics or the non-perturbative physics associated to deep brains as well. Specifically, what my collaborators and I have been researching recently is a ways to concretely calculate from the point of view of Calabi-Yau geometry the back reaction of deep brains within Calabi-Yau spaces. As a very loose description of what this looks like, you have these non-perturbative objects that can propagate in the spatial directions in string theory. And as a very loose analogy, just like you can have the shape of fossils in stone where the bug or critter that created this imprint is long gone, but the shape is remaining in the broader space. We are showing that singularities of Calabi-Yaus, specifically elliptically fibered Calabi-Yaus, can actually encode a huge amount of information about the moduli space of the brains that might have existed inside that geometry. So specifically with collaborators, Jonathan Heckman, Sheldon Katz, and Laura Shapoznik, we've been working on a program to describe within the context of F-theory, brain physics from the point of view of Calabi-Yau geometry in some novel ways. So specifically, F-theory encodes information about seven brains within elliptically fibered manifolds. But the open string, i.e. the D-brain sort of local physics, and the closed string, i.e. string compactification, Calabi-Yau moduli descriptions can be hard to relate. You can write down local gauge physics that has to do with D-brains, and these satisfy differential equations that live over these subvarieties of the manifold. The so-called Hitchin system is one example of this, and a type of geometry that describes these local gauge fields that are associated to open string world degrees of freedom. What is the remarkable thing that I just want to highlight? There is a very rich interplay of geometry and physics that's in play here. Building on recent work by Diakonescu, Dinaghi, and Pantev, my collaborators and I began to study limits of Calabi-Yau elliptic vibrations, in which the Calabi-Yau goes singular in a way that encodes where deep brain structure could live. So specifically using the theory of limiting mixed Hodge structures, we found that the moduli spaces of Calabi-Yaus actually include information about the emergent Hitchin systems or local brain physics. So this provides sort of a transition function between open and closed string descriptions. And geometrically is relating two very different geometric systems, that of gauge fields on subvarieties, complex curves, or complex surfaces, and the geometry of singular limits of Calabi-Yau manifolds. I referred to the slide, the elephant in the medicine cabinet. Mathematically, these are two wildly different geometric systems that in principle, their moduli spaces have nothing to do with each other. But what you can actually show is that in limits of the Calabi-Yau moduli space, the Hitchin moduli spaces are actually emergent in a very controllable mathematical way. This can lead to really interesting new control of the physics from a geometric perspective and really new mathematics. So there's been about six workshops in the last few years, including a semester-long program at the Simon Center that Lara Shapoznik and I organized last year trying to build this connection between math and physics and explore these types of new correspondences. So I say this just to illustrate that there is a lot of dialogue that is very interesting and fruitful, both mathematically and physically, at this interface. All right, I have talked to you about a wide range of subjects in string compactifications. If this isn't a subject that you're interested in, what is the couple of things that you should remember from this talk? The work that I described here is part of a broader program, which is, can string theory actually make contact with realistic physics in a controllable way? Can you actually decide whether string theory is useful for 4D physics in our world or not? The answer may very well be no, but if you could, rule it out, that would be very interesting in my opinion. In order to do that, you have to control manifolds and bundles in a very detailed way. This involves bounding and constraining these types of geometries that arise in string theory. So engineering quantum field theories to match observable particle physics cannot be separated from the problem of bounding and classifying geometries. And we've developed lots of novel mathematical tools, including whole new areas of research in both physics and mathematics. For example, this correspondence between Calabi-Yau and Hitchin moduli spaces is one recent example. So despite the fact that this subject has a 30-year history, there's a whole bunch of new tools on the horizon. And the game is to make contact between very diverse areas of mathematics and physics and hopefully share perspectives from both of these fields. So I would argue that this is an interdisciplinary boundary of string theory and geometry. It's just starting to be explored in earnest, and I hope you will stay tuned in the future. So with that, I will stop there and say thank you for your patience.
Okay, great. Thanks, Laura, for a fascinating talk. Here's us all. Thank Laura. Okay, great. So we have time for a couple of questions. So I'll open up the floor to questions for the speaker. So normally, I guess we start off with questions from students. So first, let me ask if any of the students present have questions for the speaker. And it's always hard for me to tell who's a student on this list or not. Okay, right, so the students are feeling shy. Maybe I can start off, with the question. So since I'm a cosmologist, I have to ask you about dark energy, which you mentioned, right? So I've been told over the years that it's very difficult, for string theory to generate a positive but small cosmological constant. Are there any, are there any new ideas on that front?
Great. So short answer is no, I do not have a solution to the cosmological constant problem in string theory just yet. But I would say that this question of where you're looking is actually really important. So, within the broader Swampland program, there's questions about, desiter vacua more broadly and whether you can really realize them in any corner of string theory, which is great to attack. But the sort of classic ways of trying to accomplish this in string theory were looking at solutions of string theory that might have nothing to do with, for example, particle physics. Mm-hmm. So I would argue that the question of getting the cosmological constant right, you really need a vacuum of the theory, and you need to know that you're in the right corner of string theory to even be talking about our universe. You better have chiral matter in the game before you, try and find the exact value of the cosmological constant in your vacuum. So I think actually the constrained elements of this theory, in my personal opinion, I think we're missing something compelling in terms of producing vacua of the type we want. But it may be that by actually understanding these constraints better, maybe we actually understand the ingredients or lack thereof better. Maybe it helps us to rule out and say, no, string theory really can't produce anything with a positive cosmological constant, and we're done. Or perhaps it'll tell us what the missing pieces are that we need to achieve this. So yeah, more constraints, the better, I would say. But no, I don't have the answer on that one yet.
Okay, great, thank you. Okay, any further questions for Laura?
I have one question.
Yeah, please go ahead.
So the compactification may tell us about may allow us to consider the small microscopic structures of space-time, then if we consider very high frequencies, for example, the high frequency modes of the gravitational waves, it may feel like the microscopic structure of space-time and the dispersion ratio of the gravitational waves would be modified. in such a scale. Then I imagine that in such a case, the speed of the Gaussian waves will be modified in general, since the dispersion relation is modified and the group velocity may deviate from the speed of light.
Mm-hmm. You're thinking about like large extra dimensions in this context in general, or you know, just
yeah. And do you know such a kind of work have been done so far? Or do you have some observation for that? Sorry for the rough question, but.
I think I get the question. I know people have been looking at this. I personally have not yet looked at this in detail. I mean, I think the question of large extra dimensions and exactly what distance scales are, you know, compatible with what physics, I mean, certainly, you know, at the particle collider level, this is something people have looked at a lot. Whether you could look for gravitational wave signatures of the type you're describing, I think is something that has certainly been considered. To the best of my knowledge, I think that is not within current observational reach, but that is definitely something that I think people would consider in the future. There could certainly be constraints. In general, from gravitational wave physics, you know, there is a lot of interesting questions at that interface.
Do you think in such a case the Lorentz symmetry is still protected, or Lorentz symmetry could be broken?
Within the string context or just more broadly?
In the string theory context.
Certainly Lorentz symmetry is preserved at the distance scales that we observe topologically.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay. Laurent, you have a question?
I have a question. Thank you for this review. It's a question more motivated from the quantum gravity point of view, and maybe it's a question about the premise of the program. That is, you're describing this program that described this small compact dimension as being classical geometry, right? Mm. But if I think naively from quantum gravitational perspective, the small dimensions are going to be very quantum gravitational. So in some sense, I understand that this is a good place to start, but it seems, I don't know what's the word, maybe a bit naive to just stick purely geometrically, and whether people have thought about it, and then whether in fact that could solve some of the puzzles. That is, would you agree that these small dimensions, if they exist, they are not classical geometry.
Certainly not. And I mean, the broader question of string field theory is an important one to be addressed. I mean, I know this is something that you and, you know, George have thought a lot about here at UT. I think that's a fair comment to make. And there's certainly more questions that one should ask. I would argue that within this regime, you know, there are things that you can do to try and rule out certain classes of theories very rapidly that are still of interest. Whether you want to try other things, or you know, a more space-time up, you know, quantum motivated approach, I can see a lot of merits in approaching that. I would say there's just different classes of questions, and the question of what you can compute effectively where is important. But certainly I would argue there are definitely open questions remaining, particularly in the string field theory direction.
Enough people have, because I'm thinking maybe, like, if you think about spin, you could think of spin as being a small compactified sphere, right? But then at some point, the fact that it's a quantum sphere somehow brings in, you know, effect that really have no semi-classical analog, and which are the core of what these small spheres are about, right?
So I completely agree. I think you're referring a bit to the background, you know, independence or dependence of string theory, which is a fair question. And I don't know that I have anything super useful to say about that, but I think these are things one should continue to think about.
Thank you.
We are a bit past time. Let's stop here. So I'll thank Laura again, for a fascinating talk.
Thanks for all your patience.
And thank you all for coming.